Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump campaigned on cutting red tape. Since taking office, he signed an executive order requiring two regulations cut for every new one approved. Scaling back regulatory burdens, he says, will create new jobs. But that process is secretive, scattershot, and often led by political appointees with deep ties to industry and potential conflicts of interest. This hour on Point, the red flags of President Trump's regulatory rollbacks. You can join us on air or online. Will the president's deregulation push make average Americans better off? Or will it benefit top executives at their expense? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at the federal investigation into Jane Sanders, the wife of former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, over a land deal and a bank loan during her time as president of Burlington College in Vermont. But first, President Trump and his push to scale back government regulations. Joining me now from New York are Danielle Ivory, a New York Times reporter who covers the intersection of business and government, and Robert Federici, a reporter with ProPublica who covers campaign finance. You can read the piece they wrote and reported about the deep industry ties and potential conflicts of President Trump's deregulation teams at our website, onpointradio.org. Danielle and Robert, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having us, John.
Yeah, hi, John.
First thing I get out there on the table is I feel kinship to both of you. I've written for the New York Times for many years, and Robert, your founder, Paul Steiger, was my boss for many years at the Wall Street Journal. So let me talk a little inside baseball at the beginning. How did your partnership on this story come about?
Well, we had both been separately looking at this issue. President Trump signed an executive order back in February that ordered the creation of these deregulation teams across the government at all of the major agencies. So both of us had been filing Freedom of Information Act requests and doing some digging into the people that were on these task forces. And we found out that we were both working on it and thought it was a no-brainer to combine our reporting power and make an even better story.
Would that have been true if it was someone from another publication? In other words, Robert, is ProPublica free to work with the Washington Post or the Boston Globe if they find that they're overlapping on a story?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's sort of our model. We, for most of our significant projects, will find partners, other prominent media outlets, whether it be TV or magazines or newspapers, and we'll often collaborate.
So let me ask you to summarize and sort of make plain for our listeners whether the core issue that you were working on and concerned about, is it about transparency? Is it about things happening in secret? Or is it about the nature of the decisions that the Trump regulation team has been making?
So, I mean, I would say there were two main issues that we looked at with our piece. The first was that, you know, President Trump has instituted these deregulation task forces and all of the agencies. And we wanted to know what their histories were, who their past employers were, past clients, past funders, so that we would get a sense of what their potential conflicts would be once they were in the job.
And when you call administration officials and ask those questions, what do they say?
So that was the second issue, right? We started digging, we started filing FOIAs, we started making calls to the agencies, and you know, to be honest, we were pretty shocked with how difficult it was to even get the names, oftentimes, of appointees to these public task forces. I mean, there was an instance where we got a FOIA back and, you know, about half of the names for the appointees were redacted, which is typically something you'll see for law enforcement personnel. I mean, very, very sensitive positions. In other cases, agencies were, you know, just completely or it was radio silence. We just wouldn't hear back from them despite multiple requests. So, you know, it varied by agency how transparent this process has been, but it has been incredibly difficult to get information about who these people are and what they've been up to.
Danielle,
Go ahead. I would just add, like, there were some minor breakthroughs where, you know, Robert mentioned that there was a Freedom of Information Act request that we got back where names were redacted, and both of our organizations appealed that. But that happened to be the Department of Veterans Affairs. We reached out to them through the press office later and said, look, we're going to publish that these names were redacted and we don't feel that they should be secret. And they did eventually give us the names, and those are published in the pieces.
When you got, Danielle, the flax for these various agencies on the phone or on email, would they explain why they wouldn't tell you the names of the people involved?
Sometimes they would say that they just didn't want to talk to us at all. Sometimes, as Robert said, there would be just radio silence. There wasn't a lot of explanation for why this was not a transparent
There was not
process.
A public policy reason given for that.
No. I mean, in the FOIA response that we got back, and that's the Freedom of Information Act, there's an exemption that they use, but as Robert said, it's mainly used for law enforcement personnel, not for public officials serving on public task forces.
Now, my favorite piece of your piece was you had a description of someone coming to an agency and looping their signature on an entry form, and that description became the window into potential conflict of interest. Talk a little bit about how you guys stumbled onto that detail and what you found in that instance.
So, I mean, that was an instance of we hit a wall, right? We had requested the calendars for the appointees to the task force at the Department of Interior. You know, that's a basic record. It should be public for a public official. And we just could not get it. So Danielle actually was doing some research and came across visitor logs, you know, the sign-in sheets people have to sign when they come into the building, you know, and that created a new window for us. We could basically go through hundreds and hundreds of handwritten sign-in sheets and, you know, find instances where people came to see task force appointees and get an understanding of who they were meeting with, who was potentially influencing them during their first months in office. And like you said, what we found was that one appointee who had founded a nonprofit that was funded by pesticide maker Syngenta, one of his first meetings once he was inside the government was with the top lobbyist for Syngenta.
And that was Laura Peterson, the one in your memorable description had the big looping L for the signature?
Yes, that's right. That was Laura Peterson, who was one of the top lobbyists for Syngenta.
And do we know whether the meeting resulted in a particular regulatory change?
We don't, because all we have is that record of her signing her name on the sign-in sheet and meeting with Scott Cameron, who, as Robert had said, had founded a nonprofit that had gotten funding from Syngenta. But there were some, and we did reach out to Syngenta. We talked to Laura Peterson. We tried to talk to Scott Cameron, and we tried desperately to get the Department of Interior to answer any questions. We sent, like, I think 7 or 8 emails to them. But no one would tell us what they actually discussed. But what we did is we looked at Syngenta's lobbying records, and we saw that it was one of several pesticide companies that have been lobbying for years for changes to the Endangered Species Act, which affects pesticide companies pretty deeply.
Let me ask both of you one sort of conceptual question, which is that from your reporting and what you've discovered about the nature of the connections between people on some of these task forces and the people being appointed by the Trump administration, is the concern that the public ought to have at this point be about things that have actually been done or things that might be done? In other words, has much of this deregulatory push been affected, or is it all potential since in part because the Trump administration hasn't really filled out its executive ranks?
Well, so these task forces are a new avenue of influence. There's other ways to go about doing deregulation, but this particular avenue, they're just at the beginning of the process. A few agencies have identified regulations that they may roll back. It appears other agencies are just sort of beginning that process. So this is the start of the process for these task forces. And as to the other part of your question, I mean, as we did our breakdown of which appointees had potential conflicts and which ones didn't, appointees who had come from working for lawmakers who may have a particular ideological bent or something of that nature, we didn't include that. I mean, it's the nature of politics that you're going to have appointees from one ideology or another. Our focus here was folks who came, who have particular industry connections, and their industries or those companies are regulated by the agencies they're now at, or interact in some way with those agencies.
Danielle, let me ask you and get a quick answer from you on one question before we leave this segment, and that is, to the extent that you've covered this in past administrations, how different is this practice that you've reported on from what you've seen from, say, President Obama?
Well, as someone who covered President Obama for 8 years, transparency was never a forte of the Obama administration. I would say that this is pretty much in line, maybe just getting worse and worse.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about President Trump's efforts to ease government regulations. You can join the conversation. Will cutting red tape make America great again? Or do you worry about undoing protections for the environment, consumers, students? I'm talking with Danielle Ivory of the New York Times and Robert Federici from ProPublica about their big investigation this week into the process behind President Trump's regulatory rollback. And joining me now from Washington is Amit Narang, a regulatory expert at the liberal advocacy group Public Citizen, whose donors include billionaire George Soros. Also with us from McLean, Virginia, is Richard Williams, the former director of regulatory studies at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, founded and funded by the conservative Koch Family Foundation. Amit and Richard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Let me start by playing a clip from President Trump early in his administration when he was announcing his intention on the issue of regulatory policy.
We have begun a historic program to reduce the regulations that are crushing our economy, crushing. And not only our economy, crushing our jobs because companies can't hire. We're going to put the regulation industry out of work and out of business.
Richard Williams, if President Trump achieves that goal, puts the regulation industry, out of business, is that a good thing?
Well, I don't think he actually means put them out of business. He certainly means to slow them down. Look, every president since President Carter has been concerned about the number of regulations. When Carter took office, we had about 85,000 pages in the Code of Federal Regulations. Today, we have 185,000, and every president has tried to do something about this. The real problem with having so many regulations is when you have so many regulations that are ineffective, they drown out the ones that work. And that actually overall makes us less safe because companies are unable to focus on where the real, and agencies for that matter, are unable to focus on where the real problems are.
Now, one of the issues that's been raised, Richard, about regulation is that it kills jobs. We are now, from what we can tell, pretty close to full employment in this country. What's the evidence that regulation actually is exacting the costs that critics say it is?
Well, I think there's two things. One, I think when you say regulation kills jobs, that's really not quite accurate because obviously you have to hire a lot of people to comply with regulations. And so one issue is, are the people that are hired just to comply with regulations, are they doing something that's actually valuable or are they actually wasting their energy and they'd be better off employed elsewhere? My concern is more about how regulations affect small businesses, both the ones that are existing today and the fact that so many people now are not being able to start the businesses that they want. For the first time in history, we find that millennials are not starting many small businesses. And for people that are trying to get back in the workforce, such as women trying to reenter the workforce, immigrants and minorities, regulations make it extremely difficult for them to come in and start up their own business. So I think that's my concern.
Amit, let me pick up or start with you on the point that Richard just raised about small business. You do see arguments from across the political spectrum that things like occupational licensing regulations, that zoning regulations have a negative impact on business formation, on economic growth in certain places. Do you agree with that? And what merit do you see in the idea in general, as Richard was saying, of sorting through the harmful with the from the useful and making us all better off?
Sure. So it is important to distinguish between state and local regulations and federal regulations. You know, we're talking here and Trump is talking about federal regulations. And when we're talking about small businesses, they're mostly impacted by state and local regulations. Federal regulations generally disproportionately impact big businesses. And I think that's why we see all of the lobbying being done at agencies, and now we're seeing some of those lobbyists even make their way into politically powerful positions at those agencies. Look, I think it is important to take small business concerns into account, and that is done by federal agencies when they're issuing regulations. And there's smart ideas to do that, providing compliance assistance with regulations for genuine small business concerns. That's a smart way to do it. The problem is that when we're talking about legislative reforms or executive branch reforms on federal regulations, it's big business and big corporate special interests that are at the table, and I can tell you that they are not interested in doing anything that reflects solely small business concerns.
Richard, what about that point, the idea that at the federal level, it's not about small business?
Well, just a correction on that. First of all, I mean, it is true that small businesses are affected by state and local regulations. They are also severely impacted by federal regulations. And we look back over history of the formation of federal regulations. A great deal of them were at the behest of large businesses, because what happens is large businesses, for them to invest, say, in a piece of capital, it costs them less than it does a small business in terms of being spread out over their total amount of sales. So large businesses will come in and lobby for regulations, and it will hurt small businesses. So that's been one of the problems all along. So yes, large businesses, they have the wherewithal to come in and lobby, but generally it's not to prevent regulation, it's to get the regulations they want that put their competitors at a disadvantage.
Amit, if you had to summarize the greatest concern you have about what President Trump is attempting to do, what is it?
Well, first, let me just respond to Richard's last point. You know, it is very clear that big business corporate special interests have been fighting Obama regulations at every stage over the last 8 years. We don't see Wall Street asking for regulations because it will allow them to capture the market or capture the regulatory system. So I don't think that theory is supported by the evidence on the ground. We see business interests opposing regulations almost in a reflexive fashion under the Obama administration. Now, when it comes to what Trump is trying to accomplish, you know, one of the other big talking points that he made is that he was going to drain the swamp. And it's clear from the New York Times excellent reporting that this is not draining the swamp. Handing over agency leadership, essentially, to the corporations, the corporate special interests that those agencies are designed to regulate and have the responsibility to regulate, that is anything but draining the swamp.
Well, but just to follow up at that point, that's a process point. What is the substantive thing that you are most concerned about that the regulatory changes would about the effect that they would have on the American people?
So we are very concerned that we're going to see one of the most intense deregulatory phases in this country's history. And that is going to have tangible, harmful impacts on the everyday lives of citizens with respect to consumer protections. The CFPB, for example, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is still trying to put out regulations that protect consumers from deceptive and abusive practices by the financial industry. We're very concerned that President Trump is going to try to shut that down. When it comes to the environment, there is a very important role for the EPA to play in making sure that our federal government is enforcing federal regulations that stop environmental harms and address climate change. Look, you know, clean water, clean air, those are not state issues. And we can't just let states on their own regulate it and take the federal government and take the EPA off the beat.
Richard, let me just ask you a question quickly before I go to a caller, and that is, do you, while applauding the overall direction of what the president's doing, do you have any concern that environmental protection, consumer protection, other important functions are going to be shortchanged in this process?
No, and basically because of the process. You know, on average, agencies pass about 35 economically significant regulations every year. In 2016, the Obama administration passed about 95 regulations. And so what happened was they didn't analyze those regulations. When we talk about valuable protection for consumers, what we hope is that the regulation is going to have benefits for consumers and excessive costs. When we went
Hasn't that cost-benefit process been in place since Reagan?
It absolutely has. We went back and looked at how many economically significant regulations had fully quantified benefits and costs over a 9-year period between 2003 and 2012. It was 0.3%. So the problem is that many of these regulations are passed for other reasons than the fact that benefits exceed costs, which means they're probably not effective. So it's fine to go back and take a look at them and say, okay, now that they've been in place, which ones are effective? And in terms of having people in industry doing this, they can't do anything without going to the public if they want to roll back regulations. In fact, the orders from OMB instruct them that even while they're going through this process, they should go out to consumer groups, to trade organizations, to everyone to get input on this. So, no, I am not at all concerned. I think this is a look back every president has tried to do, and I think President Trump is maybe making a more serious effort.
All right, let's get our callers involved. We've got Jackie on the line from Somerset, Kentucky, my home state. Jackie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
What's your question for our guests?
My question was mostly just a comment. I don't start to even understand all about regulations, but I do believe that our President Trump is more than competent to understand about business because, yes, that has been his forte for most of his life. So he may not know about a lot of issues about medical, things like that, but business seems like he understands and that we should give him a chance.
Obama. Are you concerned about the issues of transparency, of not making public the names of some of the people on these task forces, for example?
No, no. I feel that he's competent enough to choose these people. He was able to in his own business, and I believe that he has the best interest for our country, where Obama has ruined it with Obamacare and allowing illegals to come in. All of these small businesses like gas stations are all through owned by immigrants now. And the average Joe could not go in there and just set up business, where Obama made regulations for immigrants to be able to come in here and do that with no money down, not have to pay taxes. And that's brought us down to a bad level.
Jackie, thanks so much for your call. Danielle, after your story was published, did you get much feedback from readers making points like Jackie just made?
Yeah, actually, we've been getting a lot of feedback from readers, not so much in the vein of what Jackie was talking about. We have actually ProPublica and the New York Times are really making an effort to reach out to readers to help us with this process, because even though we have identified 71 appointees to these task forces, there are still a lot more that we don't have. So we've been asking people who work in the federal government or have met with these task forces through a company or an organization, or have some other knowledge of what's going on inside of the agencies with regard to deregulation, to please reach out to us. And we have emails set up at both organizations, taskforce@newyorktimes.com and taskforce@propublica.org. And both Robert and my Signal numbers are available on both websites if people are interested in getting in touch with us through encrypted chat. But mostly we've been getting very positive feedback. I did get one email yesterday that just said fake news, though.
I understand that. I've gotten some of those myself. Let's go to another caller. We've got Jay on the line from Tampa, Florida. Jay, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Go right ahead.
I remember that at one time in America, there were large bodies of water bursting into flames because of so much toxic waste being dumped by industries, and we had to have clean air and clean water regulations so we don't end up looking like what much of China looks like now with smog so thick you can't breathe. America for many years has been criticized for having foreign policy driven by oil interests, and now we have Rex Tillerson, the executive of an oil interest, is the leader of our foreign policy, and that is absolutely going to have regulatory effects. Betsy DeVos invested in charter schools and defunding public education, and now she's in charge of the Department of Education. It's going to have regulatory effects. This is why they wanted Trump. He's a weak president. Every business he's been a part of has failed, and now influential people with the money and power to change the rules are doing that at free will.
Jay, thanks so much for your comment. Richard Williams, do you think that people who are pushing for deregulation may be forgetting how things once were and the progress that we have made because of regulations on the environment, for example?
I certainly hope not. And I couldn't agree more. I think we still have rivers that are polluted, and we still have some clean air problems. My issue is, I want to make sure that what we're doing from this point going forward, including some of the recent regulations that came out of the last administration, are going to be effective. For example, I wonder about the Waters of the United States regulation. The Army Corps of Engineers expressed a lot of concern about both the legal, but also the analysis, the economic analysis. Was it going to be effective to go after smaller bodies of water? I mean, almost down to puddles, it seemed. So what I want to make sure is that we're focused on solving those problems, but not just continuing to just expand the reach and continuing to pass regulations that don't really effectively solve those problems.
Amit, your view of the Waters of the United States rule?
I do, and it is a critical rule in terms of ensuring clean water. We have many, many clean water issues in this country. You know, you can look at Flint, you can look at the toxic algae blooms in Ohio, in the Great Lakes. And right now, we don't have any regulation in place to ensure clean waters. And the caller is absolutely right. There are real costs, quantifiable, non-quantifiable, to having a lack of regulation and deregulation. Quantifiable, all we have to look at is the deregulation of Wall Street leading to the 2008 financial crash that cost our economy $14 to $20 trillion, cost millions their homes, millions their jobs. And you can't quantify what it means when your child doesn't get asthma or doesn't get poisoned by lead in the water. And so the benefits are real. They may not be able to be quantified. That is not a reason to stop critical public protections.
Amit Narang from Public Citizen, Richard Williams from George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at President Trump's efforts to cut government regulations and some of the concerns surrounding that process. You can join the conversation. Should there be more oversight of the president's regulatory rollbacks? Or is Donald Trump changing Washington in the right way? I'm talking with Danielle Ivory from The New York Times and Robert Federici from ProPublica about their investigation into President Trump's process for rolling back regulations. I want to go to one of our callers again. Becky is on the line from Lockhart, Texas. Becky, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I'm very concerned about the consumer representation during any of these policy decisions regarding the environment and so many things. And I'm wondering who we can contact, and I'm grateful for the journalists there.
Robert, why don't you take that?
Sure, and we're grateful for readers like you. What we know about this process is that some agencies have will be receiving public comment. They've set up email addresses. The EPA has held public hearings. But what we discovered was that a lot of, the big time industry lobbies were not attending those hearings. And what we learned is that these task forces are also having meetings behind closed doors with task force appointees. These groups are hiring lobbyists, they're hiring attorneys and economists who will help them make their cases. We've talked to experts, it's yet to be seen for sure, but it appears that this, you're not going to be successful in this process if you don't have deep pockets and you can't pay for the kind of analyses that these agencies need to successfully overturn a rule. The callers earlier talked about, there's one concern with small businesses, another with large businesses. This is not a process that you can go through cheaply.
Let's take another call. We've got Jake on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. Jake, welcome to the show. You live in a state that has more influence on presidential politics than most other places. What's your concern?
Well, I guess my concern is that it's not about reversing or these regulations. It's about increasing them. I mean, here in the state of Iowa, we've had a 15% increase in the last 2 years of nitrate levels within our water systems. And also that right now there's 630 impaired waterways within the state. I have little faith in the administration in, strengthening our ability to protect our waterways. And so I'm just wondering what the panel can say about what can we be proactive about, A, not having these reversed, and B, increasing them. I mean, when people talk about the consumer or about the issues with small businesses, it's more important to keep our environment clean. So I just was wondering what their panel would say about what we can do about being proactive and that. So,
Danielle, let me ask you, what is the contact point for a citizen? We know that lobbyists and businesses and interest groups in Washington, like Public Citizen, know how to get their voice heard in the process. How does a citizen like Jake get to do that?
Right. Well, as Robert had mentioned, several of the agencies are taking public comments on this process to identify regulations that could be eliminated or rolled back or streamlined. Unfortunately, there's no central point, but the way to look for a point is to go to the agency itself. Most of them have switchboards that you can call into. You can also look on their websites. EPA, for example, has a website set up specifically to deal with regulatory reform issues. You can also go to regulations.gov and look for places where agencies are accepting public comments, and they accept them through regulations.gov. Anytime an agency is trying to add a regulation, whether that regulation is to roll back a current regulation or to increase some sort of protection, the agencies have to ask the public for comments as well. So if there are specific regulations that you are concerned about, you can go to regulations.gov when those regulations are being discussed and actually give a public comment. But, you know, as Robert said, what we're seeing is that industry groups, though they often will also send a public comment in writing through regulations.gov, they're also setting up meetings behind the scenes, behind closed doors, with members of these task forces. And we really don't even know the extent to which that's happening, because we've asked for correspondence and calendars at every one of these major federal agencies and have yet to get anything back except some correspondence from the Small Business Administration.
Now, we heard earlier from President Trump with his promise for what he was going to accomplish with deregulation. Let's take a listen to one of his antagonists in the Senate, Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, when she was urging fellow senators unsuccessfully to deny the confirmation of Naomi Rao to head the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is known as OIRA.
If confirmed, Professor Rao will be perfectly positioned to put her theories into practice. She will head the Trump administration's efforts to toss out the rules that big businesses don't like. She will determine whether rules go through the slanted OIRA process. She will have the chance to gut strong rules that help working families.
Robert Federici, explain to our listeners what OIRA is and what its power is.
So, I mean, you know, Senator Warren's famous statement, right, is that politics is personnel. And OIRA plays a very crucial role between the White House and the agencies as regulations are changed, whether it's rollback or regulations are increased. What we're seeing here, though, you know, is that, you know, we have a new administration that's come in. We've talked to industry groups that have said that the last administration was not hearing their concerns, whether it's the oil industry, the coal industry, medical device makers. And they are very excited about the fact that there's an administration in place now that will be hearing their concerns. And there's a rush to sort of get to the front of the line and get their concerns on the agenda while a friendly administration is still in place.
Danielle Ivory, New York Times reporter who covers the intersection of business and government, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for your reporting. It was a terrific story we talked about today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Robert Federici, a reporter with ProPublica who covers campaign finance. We appreciate your time and look forward to your partnerships with news organizations of all sorts.
Thank you.
In a moment, we're going to look at the federal investigation into Jane Sanders. She's the wife of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, of course, the prominent Democratic presidential candidate last year, over a land deal and a bank loan during her time as president of Burlington College. That has now provoked an investigation. Bernie Sanders has said that this investigation is politically motivated, but we're going to talk about that in a moment. This is On Point. Federal authorities are looking into a 7-year-old land deal for a Vermont college that ultimately led to the ouster of its president. Jane Sanders was forced to resign in 2011, and the cash-strapped college closed last year. Joining me now with the latest is Morgan True, the Burlington bureau chief for VT Digger. It's a statewide online news outlet that focuses on Vermont state government, politics, business, and public policy. He's been covering this story in the closure of Burlington College. Morgan True, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
Morgan, can you just walk our listeners through exactly what the controversy is?
Yeah. So, as you said, in 2010, Burlington College, a small liberal arts college here in Burlington, the largest city in Vermont, was looking to purchase a new campus from the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington, which was selling 33 acres of prime lakefront land because they needed money to settle church priest sex abuse scandals. And so Jane Sanders led this effort, and she got a lot of buy-in from the board, at least initially. They had about 150 students at this time, and the plan was to increase enrollment to about 500 and also to bring in more revenue, but also to use a fundraising campaign to support the purchase of the new campus, which cost a total of $10 million. And they got a loan from the diocese and then they also got a loan from People's United Bank that they actually secured with tax-exempt bonds through a lending agency, a state lending agency here in Vermont. And so as part of the loan agreement, Ms. Sanders represented to the bank that she had $2.6 million in confirmed, valid, enforceable pledges. And that's in the loan agreement. And at some point between when the purchase went through in January of 2010 and August of 2011, when they were negotiating a new contract for Jane Sanders as president, the board lost confidence in this vision that she had put forth. And my sources who were involved with the college at the time say that had everything to do with, or mostly to do with, the fact that these pledge donations, these gifts, were not materializing.
Now, Morgan.
And so, go ahead.
No, go ahead. So the gifts were not materializing.
Correct. And she's forced out by the board in October of 2011. Lawyers get involved. She's given a $200,000 severance package, and she's given the title of president emeritus, and not a lot is said publicly by the trustees at the time about why she has to leave, and people largely move on. One of her top deputies becomes president, but in 2014 it comes out that the college's accreditation is in trouble, and we subsequently learn that it's in deep financial trouble. And it appears that that's largely because of the debt from this multi-million-dollar bank loan that they used to finance the purchase of the campus. Enrollment hasn't increased, and we learn that they only ever collected about $600,000 of that $2.6 million that Jane Sanders had represented that they would, get in charitable gifts.
How did the investigation get started?
And so in 2015... Well, so the investigation gets started after we did some reporting in 2015 where we interviewed donors who told us that their personal financial records showed that their pledges were overstated in this loan document, and that the largest pledge, a $1 million gift, which is represented as, a series of cash payments, is actually a bequest from an elderly woman who had promised to give money to the college upon her death. And she actually only ever gave the college, less than $100,000. So nowhere near this $1 million. And again, it wasn't a sequential gift. It was a bequest, something that she said would be paid out upon her death. And so Republican attorney here in Vermont, Brady Tunsing, filed a complaint with the U.S. attorney in Vermont and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which regulates large banks, and says that these mesh representations amount to criminal loan fraud. And we learn later on, because of emails between the state of Vermont and the U.S. Attorney for Vermont, that the FBI has begun an investigation at some point. And a former college employee has told us that they received a subpoena in February 2016.
And Morgan, is there any suggestion that there was a corrupt motive in the whatever happened with the representations that were made, the attempt, the loan that was obtained, the effort to expand the college that then didn't work out? Is there any suggestion of a corrupt motive in all that, as opposed to management decisions that may have been poorly thought out or didn't work?
Well, so I've spoken with an assistant U.S. attorney about what it takes for misrepresentations to become criminal fraud, and that requires a showing of intent. And at this point, it's difficult to know. I mean, I've had people close to the college say, no, this was just pie-in-the-sky thinking and ham-fisted mismanagement. But that is really what federal investigators are likely looking into right now. We know that they're gathering information. We know that they subpoenaed other records in April from this lending agency. They've spoken to some people connected to the college, and I'm guessing that what they're really trying to establish in order to decide whether to pursue an indictment before the grand jury here in Vermont is whether they can show that there was some kind of intent to deceive the bank when these pledges were misrepresented.
What about the argument that Bernie Sanders has made that because Brady Tensing is involved in Republican politics, as his mother, who is an attorney in Washington, and her husband, who is also an attorney in Washington, are, is there a reason to think that that is a legitimate complaint by Sanders?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that Brady is a partisan, and that he has gone after other Democratic or left-leaning politicians. But he is also, he works very hard when he comes up with, these allegations, because he's basing them off of public records, off of investigative reporting by us and other outlets here in Vermont. And
Morgan
so,
True, we're out of time. I've got to thank you for joining us. Morgan True's Burlington Bureau Chief for VT Digger. Thanks for being with us. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org.